Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free and available when you're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it to any type of a device, your computer, a Microsoft Surface, for example, or any listening device. Today we have an interesting show where we're going to highlight the challenges of over-collection of ESI and what they present to corporations. And this is a problem which is often like an iceberg. The problem is much larger if you look at it under the water than from the surface. We're going to talk about some data which Microsoft compiled last year to assist the advisory committee and its discovery subcommittee with their attempt to understand whether the federal rules on e-discovery require amending because of the tension between over-collecting ESI and being charged with spoliation if parties somehow miss ESI or destroy ESI. This risk is present even if their conduct was due to mistakes which range from forms of negligence rather than reckless or intentional conduct. It's a complex issue, which I wanted to also weave in some of my thoughts on predictive coding and analytics after we've had a chance to discuss the scope of the problem. Because the end of the program is something I refer to as nirvana, and it's something I've been thinking about and talking about and blogging about, and I also don't think anyone in the country has tried what I envision using predictive coding as a solution for, I figured I would join the show as one of our quasi-panelists in addition to the moderator for the end of the discussion. This panel is really outstanding, so it's going to be a memorable show, even if my nirvana idea is a dud. So our guests are as follows. We've got Judge Paul Grimm, who was recently appointed as District Court Judge for the United States District Court for the District of Maryland, and prior to this, had served as a magistrate judge since 1997. Additionally, Judge Grimm is an adjunct faculty member at the University of Maryland School of Law and also the University of Baltimore, I believe. Right, Judge Grimm?
That's right.
Where you teach trial evidence, pretrial civil procedure, scientific evidence. Judge Grimm is a frequent lecturer at CLA programs on issues regarding evidence and civil procedure and has published several books and numerous articles on these topics. He's, of course, very well known for his thoughtful e-discovery opinions, such as Mancia versus Mayflower Textile Services on cooperation proclamation. You got Victor Stanley versus Creative Pipe and the need to explain why search terms are being created when privileged materials were disclosed to the other side. Markle American Insurance Company, which is on the admissibility and authentication of ESI. Hobson versus Mayor of Baltimore on the complications of privilege waiver with the disclosure of privilege or work product ESI between different state jurisdictions, which still need to be addressed, although now we have Rule 502. He took a break from the e-discovery circuit for the past year while he was going through the confirmation process. So this is Judge Grimm's first program at ESI Bytes as a federal district court judge for the state of Maryland. You've now passed Ron Hedges, who had tied you as the most frequent guest on ESI Bytes. So congratulations on the new position. It's good to have you back on the show.
Thanks, Carl. I appreciate it very much.
Okay, and then we've got Judge Joy Flowers Connie, who's a federal district court judge in the Western District of Pennsylvania and is one of the thought leaders behind the Special Master Program launched as a pilot program in the Western District of Pennsylvania a few years ago. She's been active working with me in Pittsburgh in our local Friends of eDiscovery group, which I run, helping it function as a model think tank where in-house lawyers, outside lawyers, technologists, judges, law clerks can meet quarterly for an informal breakfast and discuss the sorts of e-discovery issues which are seldom raised in court. One of the programs we did recently covered this exact topic where we had a spirited discussion on the Microsoft letter and the RAND study and how collections play out from the real-life experiences of lawyers and companies in Pittsburgh. Judge Conte, like Judge Grimm, is well-known nationally on the e-discovery circuit and frequently speaks at national conferences. Prior to her appointment, she was a shareholder with the Pittsburgh office of Buchanan Ingersoll, now Buchanan Ingersoll Rooney. Prior to joining Buchanan, she was a partner with Kirkpatrick Lockhart, which is now known as K&L Gates. Our third guest is David Howard, who's new to ESI Bytes. He's at Microsoft. He's one of the signers of the Microsoft letter we'll be discussing as part of the show. This is one of the more fascinating documents I've ever read in eDiscovery, and it's available on the Internet if you just want to do a search for it using Dallas, Collections, eDiscovery, and Microsoft. It'll pop up. David's a corporate vice president and deputy general counsel for litigation. He joined Microsoft in 2010 and is responsible for Microsoft's litigation on a worldwide basis. Prior to this, he was litigation partner in the Philadelphia office of Deckert, LLP, where he co-chaired the firm's White Collar and Securities Litigation Group. He's been repeatedly recognized as one of the leaders in his field by such legal ranking services as Chambers USA, Legal 500, Best Lawyers in America, and Benchmark Litigation, and was named a, quote, top gun in the corporate compliance area by Ethisphere magazine. And then my name for the bit I'm being a panelist is, of course, Carl Shinneman, and I'm going to inject some of my thoughts on predictive coding. So I'm going to be a hybrid guest moderator, and in addition to creating and hosting ESI Bytes, I spent the past almost 4 years pushing for more use of analytics and involved in the predictive coding. I started a consulting practice called Review Less, and 2 years ago, worked with a lawyer in Pittsburgh named Tom Grix to try to find a case to show that predictive coding could be used even when another party was adverse to it, and we got that chance last year. This was, of course, Global Aerospace. That journey is connected to a podcast I did with Judge Grimm and Judge Facciola back in 2010 on how to defend a predictive coding case, which is how my first client, Predictive Coding, decided to give me a call. So back then, that show seemed to be as close to nirvana. And, of course, now since Global Aerospace completed a production using the predictive coding, it's not nirvana anymore. Hopefully we can draw the same conclusions about some of today's show in 2 years or less. So let's start the show with a brief disclaimer. These views presented in the show do not represent the views of the organizations which the speakers come from, but are their individual thoughts at this moment in time in e-discovery, which we all know is a constantly changing field. So, David, we often start the show by asking our guests how they got started in e-discovery, and since you're a new guest, why don't we start with you, and then maybe Judge Conde and Judge Grimm can chime in.
Sure. Well, thanks, and thanks for having me on. I guess the answer to your question about how I got started in e-discovery was I joined Microsoft in August of 2010, and I really didn't have a choice. There is, not surprisingly, given the scope of our organization, a tremendous focus on e-discovery and the problems that it creates and the resources that it draws. In our litigation group, we have 4 full-time employees devoted to e-discovery. We use a number of different vendors in various different parts of the process. We obviously use a large number of reviewers of documents. And e-discovery impacts, oh gosh, in excess of 6,700 employees whose data is currently under hold. So it's a big problem for us. It's a big focus for us. And so I didn't have any choice when I joined the company but to become knowledgeable about it and become involved in it.
Okay. Judge Conde?
Well, when I started as a federal judge about 10 years ago, a few years into my time on the bench, I had a case that raised a very complex issue regarding electronic discovery, and as I was the chair of our court's local rules committee, I felt it would be important for my court to have local rules that dealt with e-discovery, and so really more by the process of just judging and then being involved with the development of local rules, I became more and more familiar and more involved in this topic.
Okay, and Judge Grimm?
I think my experience is similar to that of Judge Conte. In the almost 16 years that I was a magistrate judge, obviously one of the areas that we deal with all the time was discovery practice. Also, as a person who was on the co-chair of our court's Local Rules and Forms Committee, and someone who taught these subjects in law school, I was very concerned when in the 2000s, 2001, 2002, the issues associated with the volume of digital information, most acutely as it deals with Rule 34 document production discovery, began to concern me that this was a tidal wave that was approaching the shore that a lot of us had not previously been aware of. And in a number of cases that I had piqued that interest, and ever since then, there have been a succession of them that have come in that direction. And for the last 3 years, of course, as a member of the Advisory Committee for the Rules of Civil Procedure and the chair of the Discovery Subcommittee, a significant amount of our time has focused on the 2006 changes and whether additional changes are needed in order to address some of the problems, Carl, not least of which you've identified as the subject of this podcast.
So let's start the show by getting some background. You mentioned the committee that you're on there, it led Microsoft to writing this letter. And Judge Grimm, you were at the Duke conference, and you were in Dallas where the eDiscovery experts Blue Ribbon panel met to discuss spoliation standards, collection standards, whether eDiscovery rules could be tightened. Would you care to sort of provide a lay of the land between these initiatives right now?
Sure, and I think that people who are involved in the litigation process, whether they represent plaintiffs, defendants, governmental entities, corporations, all have an equal concern in trying to deal with this this area and to try and see if we can get it as right as we possibly can. You've got in our system, and Judge Conte, of course, is well recognized for her thoughts in this area. Whether we like it or not, we have a common law obligation that we inherited through our common law system from Great Britain, that there is a common law duty to preserve evidence that is relevant to claims and defenses, and the duty triggers when someone reasonably anticipates litigation. That standard, or a version of it, is part of the state common law and the federal common law throughout the United States. The rulemaking process, it has to take place in the context of the limitations imposed by the Rules Enabling Act, which forbid, through ordinary rulemaking, through the rulemaking process, a court to either create or abrogate evidentiary privileges or to affect the common law standards that may exist. So in making a rule change, the court is or the committee is restricted to trying to focus on matters that would be procedure versus matters that are substantive, and that's a dividing line which is sometimes very difficult to draw, and reasonable minds can disagree about whether where it has been drawn. As the Microsoft letter, which was really as much as the content of the letter, but the graphic of it, of the pyramid, the upside-down pyramid, of the enormous volume of information that may well have to be preserved by a company, for example, Microsoft, or a government agency that has potentially litigation, maybe constantly under a duty imposed under the common law because they have many lawsuits or events that could foreseeably result in lawsuits, then the amount of information, given the number of individuals who have access to multiple digital platforms, that they may have to that fall within the duty to preserve to avoid the collection of potential sanctions, many of which can be very, very, very onerous, has led to a overproduction or overpreservation by large organizations for fear of having no consistent national standard that governs and no consistent level of culpability or harm that has been identified as the dividing line between sanctionable conduct and conduct that would not result in sanctions. I think it was pretty well accepted that after the 2006 changes to the Rules of Civil Procedure to deal with ESI discovery, that there was no explicit discussion of preservation, a common law obligation, or the limits of preservation, and nor was there a standard that would identify the level of culpability and harm or prejudice necessary to try to identify when sanctions could be imposed. This was highlighted at the 2010 Duke conference, which was sort of a watershed time when there was a rethinking of the existence of where we were with the rules of procedure. That, in turn, the Standing Committee on the Rules of Civil Procedure has a number of subcommittees, one of which is the Duke Committee, chaired by Judge Kodal of the Southern District of New York, who was his hard work and vision was what made Duke the success that it was. My subcommittee that I chair is the Discovery Subcommittee, and our two committees overlap, and we each serve on the other subcommittee. And we have been, since that time, trying to come up with a rule proposal that would improve the status quo. It can't solve it to everyone's satisfaction. The Dallas conference that occurred in the fall of 2011, where folks at Microsoft and a lot of other people showed up to give us on the committee guidance and information for food for thought, took place. Those recommendations, as well as those from others, were the subject of reflection by the Discovery Subcommittee. And in our last meeting of 2012, the committee approved, the full Civil Rules Committee approved submission to the Standing Committee, which has to approve any rule that might go to the Supreme Court, and then to public comment, and then if approved to the Supreme Court, approved for publication this summer a draft Rule 37E that is an attempt to, after a good deal of hard work over the last couple of years by the Discovery Subcommittee, to put a rule out there for public comment to try to see if we can't address, to the extent allowed within the limits of rulemaking process, these concerns about overpreservation and sanctions. And that's sort of where we are now. The publication will occur sometime this summer, and the publication is not of a rule, but of a draft rule, and it's designed to allow people then to comment. And based upon those comments, the subcommittee and the committee will have to decide whether the minor or significant modifications are needed, and whether or not we go forward with a rule at all.
Sounds like another podcast when that comes out, so we'll put that on the calendar. So David, you and some of your colleagues drafted this letter. Let's talk about some of the highlights or results from the letter, which really illustrate how messy and untargeted collection and processing phase of e-discovery is. So first of all, how did you approach this analysis?
We wanted to determine what the relevant statistics were for the average case, litigation case at Microsoft. And obviously, you know, we have all manner of cases from, you know, large antitrust matters to a lot of intellectual property litigation, including patent litigation, some involving other operating companies, some involving non-practicing entities, to small one plaintiff employment cases. So we decided that the most the best way to look at this was to look at the average case.
Okay. And you know, what does the Microsoft litigation hold portfolio look like in, is according to letter, and based on size of data per case and how many custodians and impacts?
So the average case, we preserve data for 45 custodians, and that is equivalent to over 787 gigabytes. If you translated that into a number of pages, it would be almost 48.5 million pages preserved per case.
Wow. Okay. You know, if we take that through that pyramid that Judge Grimm alluded to, which I think is just like an unbelievable pyramid, so let's take it from preservation, production, and then all the way down to trial.
Sure. And it's a shame that this isn't a video cast, because the graphic is pretty amazing, but I'll try to explain it orally. So we go from that 45 custodians, 787.5 gigabytes preserved. Then we go down in the actual litigation, how many custodians' information do we collect and process in response to discovery requests? And we go from 45 to 12 custodians. We collect and process about 200 gigabytes on average per case, which is almost 13 million pages collected and processed. The next question is, of that 13 million, how many are actually reviewed? And so now we take a step down, and we review about 10.5 gigabytes per case, which is equivalent to about 646 million pages. 645,000, 646,000 pages per case. How many of those are actually produced? Again, that's a smaller subset. So now we're producing, on average, about 2.3 gigabytes per case, or about 141,500 pages. And then if you look at the statistics, which we believe to be representative of what happens at Microsoft in terms of how many of those are actually used as exhibits, it's about 10%. So our best estimate is of those 141,000 pages, we're talking about 142 pages that are actually used.
Wow. And, of course, this all has a cost, and you did some estimates on the cost to produce a single page in litigation. You know, you want to share those sort of...
Yeah, I don't think we have a dollar value, but obviously you'd have to look at data storage fees, attorney's fees, licensing fees for our vendors, employee salaries, and, you know, all of those are quite significant, but I would say the biggest cost to the company has to do with, you know, the disruption on the business and the impact that it has on productivity. When you think about it, it's really pretty startling that, you know, for each one-page trial exhibit that gets used, we collect more than 90,000 pages and preserve almost 340,000 pages.
Did your jaws all hit the ground when you finished doing this analysis? I mean, were you know, intuitively you must have known there was a problem because you're living it, but that is a huge gap.
It really is a huge gap. And, yeah. You know, from our perspective, it stems from the fact that, you know, we don't have a whole heck of a lot of guidance and certainty about, you know, in any given case, what we ought to be preserving. And, you know, in many cases, plaintiffs use that against us and try to force us to preserve much more information than we think is relevant in a particular situation in order to drive up our costs and to promote settlement.
So, Judge Connie, we had the opportunity to talk together among lawyers in Pittsburgh once a quarter in our Friends of eDiscovery meetings, and you actually suggested at a planning meeting in January 2012 of going into the nuts and bolts of collection as a topic for our group to share what they encounter as education for you and some of the other judges and law clerks, as well as all the participants. Why did you think this was a good topic?
I thought it was a good topic because as a judge, I always like to try to understand what the real problem is that is facing the parties before me. And when you get into these discussions on e-discovery, the lawyers have a tendency just to stand up and say, oh, it's too costly, it's too time-consuming, it's a big problem. But I don't understand why. And when I probe the lawyers for that, sometimes they really don't understand either. And you never can get a quantification of what it's going to cost, how lengthy it's going to be, how many staff are going to be dedicated to this, and it changes so frequently. Years ago, the big issue was you had to have all of these backup tapes. Well, there are not too many backup tapes. Everybody's using the cloud now, and so that seems not to be as big of an issue, and it now is focusing on all these huge quantities of documents. I was very surprised that there were 45 custodians in a typical case that Microsoft had referred to. That's way too many, and I think we need to step back and see what's really realistic, and I think having a judge understand what goes on in the collection process can really help frame where the national rules are going to go and where local rules can go to try to help the parties deal with this very serious issue that we're facing.
So, Judge Grimm, you saw this presented live in Dallas. What was the reaction among this blue chip panel?
Well, I think that the panel, of course, included folks from large organizations like Microsoft. I think that GE was there and some other folks, too, who are large organizations. There were plaintiff's counsel and people who primarily are bringing litigation, and they come with a different set of concerns. But I don't think anyone could question the underlying problem that exists, nor deny that something has to be done to try to address it. I think that what the subcommittee and the committee were trying to do was to get information from all of the concerned stakeholders to try to identify a way to go forward within the structural limitations of the rules-making process to try and come to grips with those. And, for example, among the, I think the Microsoft memo and the inverted pyramid, which shows the infinitesimally small amount of information that actually makes its way into a summary judgment motion or a trial exhibit, or frankly be relevant to a negotiated settlement on the merits of the case as opposed to the cost, is so phenomenally small compared to the total amount that might have to be preserved. No one could question that. Where folks struggle is try to fine-tune when does the duty to preserve begin? Can you do better than just have the common law standard? And that, interestingly, produced some ideas that were somewhat counterintuitive, because some folks would say that the duty to preserve, the only way to try and regulate it would be is when you are actually served with an actual complaint, and now the duty to begin starts there. That would not only require a rule change that would change the common law, but there are the folks who bring claims were able to articulate concerns that were not fanciful about problems that could occur that would make that an issue from their point of view about whether or not the line had been drawn in the proper place. Other examples were if a regulatory complaint or things of that nature had been brought, but other folks were able to identify some issues associated with that might actually exacerbate the problem in their areas as opposed to remedy it, particularly since there are many organizations that have complaints filed with an organization, say, for example, the EEOC, where there's a small fraction of the number of claims that actually progress to litigation, even though they may have had a complaint filed with the regulatory agency. So there was a lot of issue about, do we have a specific trigger that we define, or do we go with the common law? Similarly, trying to come up with what the standard level of culpability would be, or the amount of prejudice, created some challenges as well. So I think that everyone in the room recognized that we've got to go forward on this. But the complexity of the problem when you're trying to come up with a rule that is one size fits all, is going to apply to a $150,000 motor tort brought in a diversity jurisdiction, as well as the antitrust case that Microsoft and large organizations are facing, is particularly difficult. This is why, candidly, there's an inherent limitation to what you can do with rule changes, and why education of judges and of litigants and of parties and of experimentation within the various districts and also looking at what the states do becomes so important as well, to try to get practice measures that make sense that are can be applied in individual cases, although not necessarily easily blended into the text of a national rule. And that's why some of the initiatives, like what Judge Conte's court has done, as well as the work out being done by the Seventh Circuit and by a number of other courts that have come up with protocols and test cases, is an area where we have to work as well as with rulemaking process. But everyone recognized the importance of the issue and of moving forward. But I don't think that we came out of that with a consensus by everyone in the room about all the aspects of what that rule might look like.
And I just want to add, I have personally been surprised at the number of people that have never seen, who are experienced e-discovery professionals that have never seen or heard of this letter. I presented it twice in group settings. Four times over the last 6 months, and it's always been new news to almost everyone in the room. So while, given our time limits today, I don't think we're going to get through all of the questions. I know we won't. At least as a part one, I think it's good that we're drawing attention to this letter as a starting point for some dialogue and experimentation, as you put out. So let's look into sort of the next question about it's experimentation. David, I always look at search as being one place where I think companies might want to focus more. And the challenges I've seen when I talk to companies is they're really not focused as much on the costs of search and retrieval. Do you think part of this is the overwhelming and all-encompassing task of collecting data represents an organization? I mean, this is a swamp, is the way I look at it, where many companies, I think, get stuck and to some extent lose interest or the ability to search much farther down the line for further efficiencies. I mean, who would want that job?
Well, not me. I'm not going to speculate about what happens at other companies. You know, I will tell you that it is an enormously complicated problem. We're constantly looking for ways to improve what we do, and it is challenging. And I'd like to think that there are a few companies out there that are more technology savvy than we are and have a better understanding of systems and what can be done in these areas. So if it's hard for us, I mean, I can imagine for a non-tech company how difficult it must be. I guess the other thing I would say is the lesson that I think we've learned and that you're hinting at is you certainly can't look at any one piece in isolation. This is a much larger problem that you have to look at every rung in the ladder to try to wring efficiencies out of it and try to figure out what the best way of dealing with the problem is.
Yeah, I want to add, I was thinking about this weekend. I was on a long ski lift skiing, and I spent at least 15 minutes thinking about this show. And, you know, I'll step up and say I myself was focused so much on search and retrieval and looked at RAN, the RAN survey, which I think everyone should look at, and you know, was looking at review costs of being 73 cents of every dollar spent. And I used to always bother me, what's wrong with companies that they don't get engaged in this challenge? But I personally missed the point, you know, despite having done 200 podcasts and attending many conferences, that collections, litigation holds, compliance, all the anticipated litigation that's out there that's not even in the courtroom that causes these, you know, that 12.5% number you put of the number of employees on a litigation hold, while the total dollar might not equal search, it still is overwhelming to deal with. It's just massive. I don't want to say overwhelming. It's massive. So I'm trying to refocus my view on this entire space with a broader view. Judge Grimm, we have this data like what Microsoft's published here online, which companies can collect internally on their own. Yet in our Pittsburgh Friends of eDiscovery networking group, and I might add in the Minneapolis group, which I helped to launch last fall, I believe if we asked if anyone had ever thought about challenging collections or at least processing on the basis that we could speed the process up by maybe iteratively starting with the 10 custodians instead of the 45 where it logically begins and point out how incredibly inefficient the current model is, you know, put another way, look at where there's fire first instead of where there might be smoke, then iteratively look outwardly. You know, is this something that is ripe for an argument right now, or are we stuck with so much precedent on ways that we've been doing it?
Well, I don't think that any of the existing precedents, and I'd be interested in Judge Conte's observations as well, prevents us from learning from what we didn't know before. And I don't think any judge or any litigant should throw up their hands in dismay and say, well, this is insoluble and we have to keep doing inefficient and costly things to try to go forward. I think this ties in with the way in which you approach it. And Judge Conte's point about when players come into court, they are not necessarily the ones who are party or the whose appearances have been entered in the case are not necessarily the ones best able to explain to the court what the gist of the real problem is, nor to approach the court with possible alternative solutions and costs associated with each, so that the court has some ability to make a principled decision about what to do given what's at issue in litigation. And of course, if litigation is not pending and you don't have the court there to get involved, it becomes dramatically more difficult, because I think, as David pointed out, if the company is if the target of the preservation demand is dealing with someone who looks at the prospect of maximum burden and cost as being a good end to achieve because it allows a settlement on cost rather than substance, then it's going to be an unsuccessful approach by the party that has the duty to collect to try to offer a alternative solution, because the economic incentive perceived by the requesting party is going to cause them to resist it. So I think that you have sort of two things to deal with. One is a rule can perhaps identify what the factors are that courts will deal with when litigation is brought, that will underscore that reasonable efforts, given what is anticipated, reasonable and proportional efforts based upon what could be anticipated, should not result in sanctions. That's helpful. In existing cases, you've got to be able to have people who can come in and articulate the problem and also propose solutions. I'm going to shut up and let Judge Conte chime in, because one of the most frustrating things for a judge is when a party comes in only raising problems but not having thought through a proposed alternative solution and expects the judge somehow through magic to come up with the solution when the parties themselves haven't given a thought to try to what that might be, subject as short of give me all of what I want or give them none of what they want, then the prospect is not rosy in that particular case for a solution unless there's a change in approach by the parties.
This is Judge Conte. We're have an advantage in the Western District because we do have the e-discovery special master program. And when I'm faced with that type of situation, I appoint an e-discovery special master. And invariably within a week to 2 weeks, after a meeting with the special master, there is a protocol worked out. It's presented to me and it's signed off on. So it has been very efficient in a way to resolve it. And I think, unfortunately, it's that there's not the right people at the table that understand the issues. So that's where I think somebody who's trained in the technologies and mediation is very helpful in this area. But beyond that, I think the fundamental problem is education of the bar, because you need to understand the problem to solve it. And lawyers simply are not well educated. The experienced litigators grew up in an era where there was no e-discovery. And I'm not sure that the law schools are robustly addressing it. I think we're seeing more and more courses on e-discovery and that type of thing in law school starting now. But we still have a problem. They come to our Rule 16 scheduling conference without really having thought out how they're going to go about doing the discovery, how it should be limited. And I think there's a level of angst at the larger companies who are often defendants in smaller employment discrimination cases that they overcollect, they are overly concerned about really addressing with the judge, how do we limit it so that it's reasonable for both sides? The companies are not addressing it up front. That's what I'm seeing, and I think that needs to change if there's going to be any effective approach.
We're going to bifurcate the show, but we'll get to some of the creative ideas I think you were talking about, Judge Grimm, hopefully in a follow-up show we can all do to complete the bookend on this. But I wanted to add one other point to this, and it is the some of the data that I presented at the end of the year that my daughter actually came up with in a survey she did for school on technology and lawyers in review. And you know, we had 218 lawyers, largely from very large firms around the country, answer a survey on how they approach litigation, types of tools, you know, review. And the most amazing statistic that popped out has nothing to do with predictive coding. This wasn't a predictive coding survey. But early case assessment, half the participants did not do any early case assessment at all. How can you start looking for where the fire is if you're not looking at your data starting in? Forget about your search methodology. I'm talking about understanding your case and talking over with your client and maybe coming up with a game plan. So maybe that's part of the problem there. You know, I think that's what we're hinting at, Judge Connie, or suggesting, is that, you know, we need to get better with technology to understand these tools. One last quick question, and then I think we're going to divide the show. And I'm going to ask this to you, David. You stepped forward with some data that was very helpful. I oftentimes find that asking companies if they participate in surveys, and the RAND Institute said the same thing to me, it's like going to the dentist. It's very hard to get companies to talk about this. Do you have any advice since you've taken this, you know, this step of releasing this data and putting it out? Is this something to be feared, or is there something helpful in doing this that you've seen and experienced?
Well, and before I address that question, because I'm not sure I'll have another chance to speak, I want to thank you, Carl, for organizing this. I'm happy to participate in another session, and I really want to thank Judges Conte and Grimm for all of the work that they're doing in this area, because it's really important, and I will continue to pledge Microsoft's cooperation in helping with this effort, because it's something that's very, very critical to us. I think the answer to the question is this. When I first started thinking with my colleagues about this letter and, you know, saw drafts of it and started playing around with it, I have to say that I was a little concerned. And you're always, you know, concerned about how something is going to be used against you and what data can be mined from this letter that somehow, you know, a plaintiff can use to suggest one thing or another. As we thought about it, you know, we thought we needed to put our money where our mouth is, that there was too much talk in generalities about what the problem was, and that people really needed to see in plain language what the numbers looked like. So we decided it was time to put our money where our mouth was and to come out with this publicly. And I guess if I have one piece of information or advice to other companies, it's simply this. Nothing bad has happened. The world hasn't ended. We haven't seen plaintiffs use this letter against us in the year or so or more that it's been out. It hasn't come back to prejudice us in any way. And I hope that other companies, and clearly other companies, see the problem as clearly as we do, that, you know, if there's any lesson here, it's that they ought to be more free to talk about their issues and how it's impacted them and what their experience has been.
That's a great final response to this, and I'm hopeful we'll be able to schedule a follow-up to some of these questions and a few more I've thought of on the creative side. I'd like to thank Judge Connie, Judge Grimm, and David for all of you for joining us here at ASI Bites. It's always a pleasure to have you and speakers like you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do more shows with you later this year. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember the show and website phonetically, as it sounds out as Easy Bytes of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, come back to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.